This is the Anthem CDA podcast, a church in the heart of downtown Coeur d'Alene. Join us as we seek the presence of God, learn from His Word, and build lifelong connections. We hope this week's teaching brings life and encouragement. Welcome to Anthem.
We're in Galatians 4 today, so if you have your Bible or your notebook, go ahead and open it. I've been really encouraged by this text, but we're going to do something a little different. I hope you guys have been enjoying Galatians so far. There's like a lot of really deep, rich teaching. Paul, as you can find, and if you just read his works, he's a really amazing teacher. He knows God's word, and he knows how to do all this interconnectivity of the gospel throughout all of the Bible. And so today, I just felt like I wanted to take a different approach. Typically, I'm someone who loves to go really deep into theology and like go just dive into the deep end and really parse through really hard to understand things. But equally, I just really love a good story. And I think that Paul is somebody who has one of the most amazing stories that I would even go a step further to challenge you. Like, this isn't just a story. This is the testimony of the life of a person who actually existed. He's not just some Bible character. He was a real man. And his story is just really encouraging. So I'll kind of give you context as to why I want to do that. But we are in Galatians 4, 1 through 20. But I want you to just go ahead and jump ahead for me to verse 12. And we're going to read that just kind of right off the gate. So it says this: "Brothers, I entreat you, become as I am, for I also have become as you are. You did me no wrong. You know it was because of a bodily ailment that I preached the gospel to you at first. And though my condition was a trial to you, you did not scorn or despise me, but received me as an angel of God, as Christ Jesus. What then has become of your blessedness? For I testify to you that if possible, you would have gouged out your eyes and given them to me. Have I then become your enemy by telling you the truth? They make much of you, but for no good purpose. They want to shut you out that you may make much of them. It is always good to be made much of for a good purpose, and not only when I am present with you. My little children, for whom I am again in the anguish of childbirth until Christ is formed in you, I wish I could be present with you and change my tone, for I am perplexed about you." So what the heck is he talking about? Like, that's how our chunk today ends. And so I was kind of placed in a unique situation, which before last week, if you guys remember, there's this really cool teaching from Paul where he's trying to help everybody understand what the law's purpose was. And he uses this analogy of an heir to receive an inheritance, but he's not of age yet. And so he's temporarily placed under a guardianship who would manage the estate until that person came of age. And there's a lot to that. And the interesting thing is, if you would just tell me, it's like, well, if we read verses 1 through 11, then we would have gotten the context, right? Like, we talk about that all the time. Like, if you just would have read before this, you would have understood what he's talking about now. That's not true right now. If you read, I'll just save you the time. If you go back and read 1 through 11, it doesn't actually set up what he's talking about right now. What you're actually seeing is the moment of a really real person who has relationship with a group of people lamenting the state of those people. He's kind of like doing an aside, which is he does start 1 through 11 by talking more about what it means to be an heir and not to live as a slave. I love how Chris put it, the how are you living, like as an heir or as a hireling. So he continues that line of thought, but then he just stops and he's just like, man, what are you guys doing? And he just kind of vents on paper, which is kind of funny because this is before texting or emails, and he felt the need to like, you know what, I'm gonna stop right now. And I can imagine him just sitting over something just like really mad, like, oh, you need to know that I'm mad at you. But there's something to that. Like, why is Paul so like upset? Like, he even does something here where, look at what he says. He says, I'm in anguish, the anguish of childbirth. Like, that's a pretty big deal to say. Like, ladies, right? Like, men aren't allowed to say that, actually. I found that out the hard way. A couple summers ago, I had a kidney stone. Sorry, too much info. But I had one, and when I was in the hospital, every doctor and every nurse is like, oh, man, people compare this to childbirth. And I was like, thanks. I can't say that ever. Like, thanks for trying to encourage me. But as soon as I say that once, it's like, oh, yeah, is it? Like, it's like, I don't know. That's what I was told. It just hurts a lot. But Paul is doing that here. So that's actually kind of a moment to stop and cue in and be like, there's probably a lot of context to what Paul is doing here. So what I wanted to do today was actually to use this second chunk to take just a breath and just go back and look at Paul's story. Because there's a lot of context for why he feels the way that he feels. Like, Paul's pain is personal. It's not just him trying to correct theology. He is correcting theology. But if we approach Galatians just like it's some theological textbook, you can miss some of the nuance of why he's saying what he's saying. Because it's not just like, oh, you guys just misunderstand like the law and like what it means. It's like, no, he's in anguish over the fact that this group of people come in and begin to subvert the teaching that he had given them. Like, this is a letter. It's not just him trying to craft theology. It's personal, it's emotional, and it's relational. So that's what we're going to do today. Sound good? Awesome. So this is one of the most influential people that has ever lived. His name is Paul. He's not just a man. He's not a character in a story. He's someone who lived a life that was so others could know Jesus. Pure and simple. Like, from the moment he meets Jesus to the moment that he dies, everything that he does is so that people could be rooted in the truth of the gospel. And so when I was kind of pitching this to the sermon group, Kenny kind of lovingly said, oh, it's just like story time with Al. And I was like, yeah, I mean, that's what we're going to do. My dad, I don't know if any of you guys know my dad, but my dad is like an amazing storyteller, and you can't just like sit down and listen to him tell a quick story. It's always like 30 minutes. And I've just like have always loved that. And I also think that early church, that's how they learned. Like, Paul's testimony was written down so it would encourage the life of the believer, because his life is crazy and he can serve as somebody who can encourage and strengthen us. So where we're at today, if you want to follow along, I'm not going to really be reading from it. I'm just going to tell you the story, but it's in Acts 13. It starts in chapter 13, verse 13. I'm just going to read how it starts. And then I'm just going to go in. So here it is, verse 13. It says, now Paul and his companions set sail from Paphos and came to Perga in Pamphylia. And John left them and returned to Jerusalem. But they went on from Perga and came to Antioch in Pisidia. Stop. How many of you tuned out? It's like, I actually didn't really think about this until reading it today, but that's like a ton of alliteration. Paul, Perga, Paphos, Pamphylia, Pisidia, like, and these are all like places that are also ancient cities. So if you like just try to go find them, like, you won't find them on a map. Like, they're probably named something different. But these are those moments in scripture where it's really easy to just kind of tune out, because it's like, oh, I don't know where any of these places are. But I just kind of want to help bring some context to you that in this story we're talking about today, Paul goes to four major cities. There's two Antiochs, so I'll also help bring that to you. There's the Antioch that they leave from. It's kind of their home base. It's in Syria. And then what this one is, it's Antioch in Pisidia. So this is a different Antioch, just in case you didn't know. But these are just really weird, strange names, unknown places. So these four cities in this story, first of all, are Antioch, Iconium, Lystra, and Derbe. And I kind of wanted to play a game. Can anyone guess where these cities are? Turkey. Wow. You would know. So John's, by the way. Yes, in Turkey. But more specifically, they're in Galatia. And if you just read Acts, you might not know that that's what this region is. And this is Paul's first ever ministry journey. So some context on Paul. I don't want to just assume that everybody knows who Paul is, but most of us do. He was firstly, his name was Saul, and he was a Pharisee. He was a teacher of the law, and not even just a teacher. He had one of the highest levels of education he could have at the time. And when the early church starts, he is so zealous for God that he thinks that this heretical movement of these people, like, obscuring the name of the Lord Yahweh, and so he hunts them down, and he persecutes them. It specifically says men, women, and children. He presides over the stoning of Stephen, who historically is known as the first martyr. And so this guy is not a friend to Christianity. He's actively trying to squash a movement of God, and he's on his way to Damascus to do the same thing, and Jesus stops him in a blinding light. And doesn't just say, why are you doing this to people? He literally puts it on himself. He's like, why are you persecuting me? And something that I've always loved about Paul's story is that he didn't need much convincing. And I think if I was in his shoes, if I was just like, oh, like I have this righteous anger, I'm going to squash this thing that I think is a danger to God. And then Jesus himself stops me and says, that's not the path you want to go. You're persecuting me, the God that you say that you love. Like, I'd be like, oh, whoa. Like, where do you want me to go then, I guess? Like, what do you want me to do? Like, there's no real turning back from that moment. Really, honestly, to turn back would just mean death. It's like, how do you be confronted with God, told to go a different direction and not do it? And he, you can tell, is very zealous for God and loves God, but he was just wrong, and he didn't understand what he was doing. And so Jesus sets his path straight. Also, I kind of jump past this. I'm sorry. Gary, can you throw up that first map? I wanted to bring some context to this, and I'm a little extra, so I wanted to make these maps. This is where those cities are. So Antioch, Iconium, Derbe, Lystra. And that radius is actually a 50-mile radius, so it's not that big of an area. You can go to the next one. For context, this is Coeur d'Alene with a 50-mile radius. Like, that's not that far. Like, it's our direct area, probably where most of you just travel normally. Like, you don't usually go that far outside of this. And for further context, you can go to the next one. I lovingly call this Coeur d'Alatia. This is where those cities would be relative to our area. So I kind of made Iconium where Coeur d'Alene is. And then you can kind of see where all those are. So this journey, and Gary, you can kind of just leave that up for the rest of my time doing this. I want you to kind of like imagine, you know, them traveling by foot, going to these different cities, and what they would be doing while I'm telling this story. So Paul has this crazy conversion story. He believes in the gospel now. He goes to Damascus, and he actually has this mantle placed on his life from a guy named Ananias, who says, he has a vision from the Lord to basically tell him, Paul, you're going to be the apostle to the Gentiles, which is a pretty heavy task considering that this is a faith rooted in Judaism, and you're going to have to go witness to a group of people that don't have a relationship with God right now. So that's a pretty heavy task, but he receives it. And it's kind of funny. I was processing this thought of like Saul to Paul is a difference in a person. But just as much as our change in Jesus is the change of a person, like you still have the characteristics that make you you. So zealous Saul, who was on a mission to crush Christianity, all of a sudden just gets like a different like view of the world. And now he's the same guy. And you can tell from his life, like he's zealous. Like he's, doesn't matter, pain of death, like he's going to spread the gospel. And so here's a little funny side story before we get into the rest of it. Paul, when he's converted, he spends some time kind of like, you know, in the wilderness, but eventually he's like, I need to go to Jerusalem. Like I need to meet the leaders of this movement. Like the people we know of from the gospels, like Peter, James, and John, like apostles that lived with Jesus. And he's like, I need to go meet them. So he's coming, he gets into Judea and everybody's freaking out. And they're like, oh, that's the dude who's killing everybody. And like, they don't believe him. They don't trust him. Nobody wants to receive him. And there's one guy named Barnabas who hears his story and is like, man, he needs to get before Peter. Like, he needs to meet these guys to see if this is true. So he takes them. He kind of like vouches for him, brings him into the inner sanctum, which would be dangerous because he's the guy who's trying to kill all of them. So to bring him into the city and like where they're at, like they're probably trying to not be found, all that kind of stuff. So Barnabas really kind of puts his neck out for Paul. And then it's just undeniable to all of the leaders in Jerusalem that, man, you, what you're saying, you had to have met Jesus. Like Jesus has been gone for a while. And like, how do you know, like, how did you go from trying to kill us to like, you just have this in-depth knowledge of the gospel, and like, you just want to preach it. And so what they actually end up doing is, we don't know who, but higher up leaders in the Jerusalem council kind of do this like apologetic tour, and they take Paul through the surrounding regions. They're like, see, he's okay now. Like, he's our friend. And it's cool. It's actually from that story says, just from seeing Paul truly love Jesus, that the church was strengthened and multiplied. This church that's trying to just exist, it's grassroots movement, it's like still kind of dodgy. Just from seeing Paul and his life changed, people are like coming to Jesus now just because they see his life. And so he spends some time in that area, and then we get to this moment. And so Paul and Barnabas kind of get linked up with each other, and the leaders of the church, they really just kind of surround them. They fast, which I really love about this story. I don't think we fast enough. Like, this was a major decision to say, hey, we need to trust Paul and Barnabas and send them out because he's the apostle to the Gentiles, and Jesus has called him specifically to do that. And so we need to pray, and we need to focus in on the Lord to see where it is that he's supposed to go. And so they fast, they lay hands, they pray over Paul and Barnabas, and then they just send them out. And so they need to go to reach the Gentiles, and then that's where this story starts. They kind of do a loop through the Mediterranean, and then now we're in Antioch. And so that's where we start. And so in Antioch, you can imagine, that's that city that's up there. They kind of swing around, now they're in Antioch. This is the first run at it. They get to the city, and they go to a synagogue. Just for context, a lot of the early church just kind of took over synagogues because that's where Jewish people came to congregate. And so it was kind of the hub of life in a lot of different towns. And again, the first ministry kind of just poured out to Jewish people first. And so they would just kind of come in as teachers, be trusted, and then they would just talk about Jesus. So a lot of the early converts were Jewish. And so Paul and Barnabas do that. They come to this synagogue, and he just begins to preach the gospel. And he preaches it in a way which just kind of blows my mind. Like, I wish I had the transcript of how he did this, because I'd probably just speak this message for the rest of my life and never change. But he basically, again, remember, Paul is one of the most learned men, and he knows the scriptures. And not only that, but now he knows how Jesus fits into the scriptures. And so he masterfully weaves all these different elements. He begins by talking about Egypt and being brought out of Egypt and the promise of Abraham through faith and just turning to Jesus for the forgiveness of your sins, how he is the Passover lamb. He talks about David, he talks about the prophets, and he just talks about how all this is about Jesus. Every bit of this is about Jesus. And he preaches so well that it says that everybody is just amazed at everything that he's saying. And they're just eating it up. And specifically, they're receiving the gospel. Like, they're finding hope in Jesus. And I wanted to take a moment to just put it on you. Like, do you remember the first time that you accepted Jesus into your heart? Some of us, we were kids, and maybe we don't remember it. But for me, it was an overwhelming experience. That feeling of like, wow, like, I actually know that Jesus died for me. And that's what's happening here. Like, this is these first moments where people are actually hearing about the gospel for the first time, and they're receiving it with joy in their hearts. So much so that they beg Paul to come back. So he gets done preaching, everybody's freaking out, they love what he's saying, and they say, would you come back next Sabbath and would you teach again? And he says yes. Like, why would he not? People are receiving it. This is why he came. And so a whole week goes by. They come back. This is crazy. It says the whole city comes. And the reason why that's crazy, synagogues weren't the biggest things in the world. Like, it wasn't like hundreds and hundreds of people were meeting in them. So this group of people that was amazed, this mostly Jewish or Jewish converts that were just in a synagogue, hearing the gospel of Jesus, go into the city and invite everybody. Literally the feeling of like, everybody needs to hear this. Jews and Gentiles, the whole city shows up. And again, it says it's just this miraculous teaching. People are receiving the gospel with joy. And it's this really cool moment. However, there's other people that hear about it too, which are the Jewish leaders in that town. And it doesn't say this, but it would be really funny if it was the guy who said, like, hey, do you guys want to preach? Like, they were there the first day. It's like, yeah, give us a word. And then, like, oh, dang it. Like, I didn't know he was going to do that. And now everybody's going crazy. And so they come into the crowds, and it says that they start shouting at them, contradicting everything that they're teaching and trying to turn people against them. But it doesn't work. And Paul does something that's pretty savage. Again, he just knows what he's talking about. He alludes to a story that Jesus says. It's the parable of the wedding feast. Is anybody familiar with that? I'll just break it down quickly, but essentially it's that there's a king who wants to throw a wedding feast for his son. And so he sends his servants to invite all like the first invited people to come. And it says some of them listened, didn't really care, went back to their farm. Some of them heard it and just forgot about it. And then others like tried to kill the servants. And so the king is upset and he's like, you know what? Servants, just go down every major road and invite every person, good and bad, and just fill the banquet hall for the feast. Just invite everybody. And he's using this as a way to point out like their hypocrisy, that Jesus has come and Jesus told this story that they're not receiving the gospel. They're still opposed to it and they don't want people to hear about the gospel. And so hearing this, it says the Gentiles in the crowd freak out even more because he's specifically saying the good and the bad, it doesn't matter who you are, you're invited to this wedding feast. And they just receive it. It says they start worshiping the name of the Lord. And they had no reason to do that. They didn't know God. They didn't have a relationship with God. But they receive the gospel. They begin to glorify him. They begin to worship him, believing in eternal life through Jesus. But again, these Jewish leaders, they went to the influential people in the town and they begged them. They're like, these guys are a nuisance. You got to get them out of here. They're causing uproar. And so these influential men and women end up, you know, ushering them out of the city. And the funny thing is, it says in the text that they shake the dust from their feet, but are overwhelmed with joy and filled with the Holy Spirit after what just transpired in the town. And that's really cool. Because that's the instruction that Jesus gave when he sends the 12 apostles out in twos, when they first do what Paul and Barnabas are doing. He says, if anybody doesn't receive you, if any house doesn't accept what you have to say or any town, he tells them to shake the dust off their feet and move on to the next one. To not take it personally, to just be like, okay, you don't want to receive it, go to the next place. And so they capture that moment and they shake the dust from their feet and they move on. But they're filled with the Holy Spirit, right? Like they had this mission to spread the gospel to the Gentiles, and their first run out of it is like really amazing. It's a huge turnout. The whole city comes. People are worshiping God in the streets, and it's like this really overwhelming, amazing situation. Like people are hearing the gospel and responding to it, and so they leave and they're overjoyed, and then they make their way to Iconium. And I want you to pay attention to the progression of this story because it gets worse. But it's also good at the same time. But their first interaction, first city, great. Knocked it out of the park. Now they're in Iconium, and Paul and Barnabas start doing the exact same thing. They just start preaching to people. Anyone that would listen, they just start preaching the gospel. And again, this time, overwhelmingly, Gentiles start responding to the gospel again, start receiving it with joy. But they probably got tipped off because the leaders, the Jewish leaders in the area, were ready to oppose them. And so they start trying to divide people and they actually start doing a better job than they did the first time. And it says they're splitting these people and trying to get them to like kind of come at each other, to not listen. And so knowing that, Paul and Barnabas kind of like dig their heels in and they start teaching more boldly and they start going after it harder and they start telling people to be rooted in the gospel because tribulation will come. And it's not going to be this easy thing. And then while they start stepping out more boldly, it says that the Lord grants them the ability to do signs and wonders, to just kind of put the cherry on top. Like, this message is true. Like, God is going to do the miraculous. And so they don't move. The Jewish leaders, they don't move. And it's this stalemate. But then there comes this point where they learn that now the Jewish leaders are actually planning on killing them. Like, it's not this just super fun thing anymore. And the city is at odds. like the first city, it was just received really well, and they were kind of ushered out, like, just stop, you know, just leave. We don't want chaos here. But they got to leave and they felt accomplished. Now they're in a city that's torn and people are fighting each other. And now there's actually a plot to kill them. Like, I don't know if you guys have ever been on a missions trip before, but if you found out someone was trying to kill you, you'd be like, yeah, I don't think I'm going to go back there anytime soon. You know, like, it's intense now. Like, it's serious. And so knowing that, they end up leaving the city quietly, and they choose to move on. But I could imagine the feeling. Like, the city was becoming less of the image of peace that Jesus brings and feeling way more like a war zone. People just fighting over, you know, what truth is. And it reminded me today, honestly, of our country and how it's pretty divided. Like, people really want the other side to know that their side is right. And we get pretty upset about it, right? And we really need them to know. But something I want you to take note of is Paul and Barnabas could have tried to rally people around them to protect them because their lives were at stake. What they chose to do instead was to leave. They didn't need to make the situation worse. They planted seeds of the gospel with a group of people, and they were instructed, or at least the apostles were, and I'm sure they probably had an understanding of this, is that if it's not being received, just shake the dust off and move on. Like, you don't need to go to war to try to, like, make sure people know it. It's like, it's honestly all of our individual responsibilities to listen to the gospel and receive it. It's not any one of our jobs to just try to convince people, because that's not even how it works. Conviction comes from the Holy Spirit. You can't say anything that's going to cut through the soul and the spirit of a person, but Jesus will work through you to do that. But if it's not received, you don't need to beat them over the head with it. So they choose to leave, and they go to a town called Lystra. And it gets way worse from here. They begin preaching just like they were before. And there's this really cool moment, which I think is really sweet, that they're preaching the gospel and there's a lame man on the ground. And Paul senses that this man has the faith in what he's talking about. That this man has the faith that Jesus, who he says he is. And it reminds me so much of Jesus's healing stories, of people that they do, that all they had to do is either touch him or all he had to do was say the word and that they would be healed. And this person has that kind of faith from the gospel being preached to him. And so Paul makes a big demonstration of it. He says in a really loud voice and just commands the man to stand up, and he does, and the whole city freaks out. It's this really cool moment. He just saved somebody. However, now they're not freaking out in a good way. They're freaking out in a pretty destructive way, because this town was really influenced by Greek culture. There was a big Greek population. There was even a temple of Zeus in this town. And so when all these people saw this incredible miracle happen, they think that they're gods. And they start saying, oh, it's Zeus and Hermes in the flesh. Like, no one can do that. Like, they just cause someone, like a lame man that we know, to stand up and walk. And so people start freaking out. And before Paul and Barnabas can figure out what's going on, it says that the priest at the temple of Zeus is already preparing an ox. They're putting the garland on him. They're going to sacrifice it to Zeus, thanking them for showing their miraculous works. And Paul and Barnabas figure, like, they hear that that's happening, and they freak out. It says they tear their garments. They're so upset. And they run into the crowd. It's chaos. And they say, please don't. Like, we're not gods. Like, you need to turn. Like, you need to follow the one true living God. Not, like, those gods don't exist. Like, follow God. We are not gods. And it says that they're not able to stop them. And they make the sacrifice anyways, which might seem trivial, but for them, this, it's already getting harder. They had a great time in the first city, second city. Now people are kind of torn. And now in this third city, the reality of reaching the Gentiles is probably dawning on them, which is these people don't know God. They think they have an idea of how the world works. They have their own set of spiritual practices, and they believe in multiple gods. And actually, an interesting thing today is I have a friend who did YWAM, and then he was in Nepal for a while. And he has these amazing stories of how they would just be walking through these villages, like in the middle of nowhere. And they had this little projector, and they would do like the Jesus gospel story. And they would, they would do like these amazing miracles. Like they would pray over people and they'd be healed. And he told me something that I never forgot, which is they received Jesus, but a lot of them didn't renounce the other gods that they followed because they're used to just being like, oh, if I want this, I go to this God. If I want this, I go to this God. And they accepted Jesus. Like, wow, obviously Jesus is powerful because he just healed this person and that's miraculous and awesome. But some of their follow through, like coming back to him and see how they were going, it's like they didn't change how their life went. They just kept going throughout their normal rhythms. But now Jesus is a part of it, you know, and now they're worshiping Jesus amongst all their other gods. And that's kind of like this moment. Like they receive the miracle and they actually want to give praise towards something, but they give it to the wrong thing. And the sad part about this moment in the story is at this point, the Jewish leaders are already just waiting for them to slip up. They've already been planning on killing them. And this is the moment that they say, see, these guys are like, they're heretics. People are praising them as gods. And they rise up this mob. They find Paul. They drag him out of the city and they stone him. And they stone him and it says that they thought he was dead. Like, it wasn't just like they want to teach him a lesson. Like, they're trying to kill him. And I just had this thought, which, again, it's not great, but I want you to think about it. If you hated somebody so much and you were towering over them with heavy rocks and throwing it at them to the point where you thought that they were dead, that person probably is torn apart. If you're throwing rocks at them, trying to kill them, and then they're so lifeless that you just choose to leave them. And that's what they do. They leave him for dead, and they think he's dead, go back into the city. And it says the disciples come out, and they grab him. And I can imagine that they were probably mourning for him. There's no way you would think he was alive. Like, a mob comes out, rips him out of the town, starts beating him. And you can imagine what he looked like. Like, he was just pulverized by rocks. But it says they go to him, and he just gets up. He just stands. And they go back into the city. Like this place where like they're being hunted now. They just go back. And the next day they go on to Derby. Just keep the train moving. Isn't that crazy? Like if someone stoned me, I'd be like, oh, I think I should go home. Like I shared the gospel. Like people heard it. I think it's time to go. You know, like I don't think I need to stay here anymore. But that's not what he does, because what he didn't do yet was establish the church. People heard the gospel and received it, but he had to leave them every single time. And so his work wasn't over. He needed to make sure that people would be strong and fed in the faith. And so literally, he goes back to every single city, back through the route, and he establishes elders in the same way that he was sent. They fast and they pray, they lay hands, and they establish the church in Galatia. And the reason why I want you to know this story is because Galatians is considered to be, if not the first written down work in Christianity, the first work of Paul. This was his first ministry journey, and this is one of the oldest documents that we have. And this is a really pivotal moment. Like, I don't think I could stress that enough. Like, they're planting this church, but this is the first concerted effort from Jesus's church to establish roots, like in this Gentile region, like to really promote the church amongst the Gentiles. Like this mission is costly, but it was worth it because now a church exists in Galatia. Paul goes through this entire trial with Barnabas, who somehow gets away with just not getting stoned, which is pretty sweet. But it's this trial, like it's a burden, like they labored for this church. And so when we read earlier that he's in anguish over this group of people, this is the context that he's talking about. And there's no definitive proof of any of this, but in his letter to the Galatians, he literally tells them, I know it was a trial for you to receive me, and I had a bodily ailment. Now, if he's addressing the church, it would make sense that he has a bodily ailment. He was stoned almost to death. He even goes as far to say, like, I swear you would have given me your own eyes. So you can imagine what his face would have looked like. Like, he really went for it. He needed these people to know the truth of the gospel because that's what Jesus charged him with. Be the apostle to the Gentiles. And so that's what he's doing. The mission is costly, but it's worth it. And something else that I love is they get done. They establish these elders and they're come to this point where they could be done and just go home. But it actually says that they feel from the Spirit that they're allowed to go home. So they didn't even just make the decision. They actually leaned into their relationship with God and petitioned. It was like, is this okay to go home? Like, is it, are we done? And they feel from the Spirit that they can go home. So they choose to go home to the other Antioch now, Syria. And the story just, again, gets more interesting. Because you'd want to take a break. You'd want to relax. Like, you'd want to be, like, tell just the stories of what happened and the people that came to faith and these big, cool moments of people coming to know Jesus. And they get home, and can you guess who they hear, this group that comes in? Could you guess who's there preaching something else? It's this group of Judaizers saying, oh, yeah, those Gentiles, they actually had to get circumcised. Everybody that you just went and did that whole circuit, and you know how you got stoned and like you were preaching the gospel, like Jesus's gospel, you got to go back and you actually have to circumcise all of them. Like, that's not just some easy, like, theological stance thing to say. Like, is that true? Like, this is a really pivotal moment in the church. And you can see how this unfolds. And I hope you guys remember in Galatians 2, this was earlier, Paul recounts this story of him standing up to Peter. Do you remember that? There's some debate on when this happened, but there's a pretty large consensus that says that Peter, ahead of this group of teachers, came to Antioch to receive them from their ministry journey. And he sat with them and they ate meals with Gentile believers and they celebrated what Jesus was doing in this new church, this new Galatian church. And then this group comes in of Judaizers preaching that you have to be circumcised to be saved. So I wanted to recount this. This is Galatians 2, 11 through 14. It says, but when Cephas, who is Peter, came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face because he stood condemned. For before certain men came from James, Judaizers, he was eating with the Gentiles. But when they came, he drew back and separated himself, fearing the circumcision party, meaning this group of teachers. And the rest of the Jews acted hypocritically along with him, so that even Barnabas was led astray by their hypocrisy. But when I saw that their conduct was not in step with the truth of the gospel, I said to Cephas before them all, if you, though a Jew, live like a Gentile and not like a Jew, how can you force the Gentiles to live like Jews? Like, that's pretty wild. Peter is Peter, like the rock on which Jesus built his church. And this group of teachers come in, and he's like eating with the Gentiles and, you know, having a good time. And they show up. He's like, oh, I'm sorry, guys, got to go. Like, can't be here anymore. And Paul sees that. Again, Paul sees that after going through everything he just went through, trying to start a church in Galatia. Here's Peter, the leader of this thing. And he stands up before all of them and says that you stand condemned because you know that's not right. And there's actually precedent for that because earlier in Acts, side story, Peter has this vision of unclean foods by Jewish law being not unclean in eating them. And at that same time, there's a Roman centurion also having a vision. And they both, because of these visions, get brought together. And Peter goes into this Roman centurion's home and begins to preach the gospel. And it says that the Spirit of the Lord descended on all of Cornelius's house. And they come to know Jesus. And Peter's takeaway from that situation is, oh, like, they can be just as they are. Like, the Spirit will fall on them just as they are. And actually, it caused some different teachings now, because now, if you were Jewish, you could have meals with the Gentiles. And just for context, that doesn't mean hanging out with them. That means eating the things that you're not allowed to eat. Eating things that aren't kosher by the law of Moses. Like, just live it up with them. Go to their houses, eat with them, dine with them. You're allowed to do that now. That was a big moment for Peter. And so when this happens later, you can tell Peter isn't teaching the circumcision thing. They just roll up on him and he's like, oh, sorry guys, gotta go. Like, it's kind of like this omission. And I wanted to highlight two things, like who is Paul and who is Peter? Because it's really comical to me that they get chosen to do what they're chosen to do. Like, Paul is an elite teacher. He's a man of Judaism. He knows all of the scriptures. He knows them intimately. And he has a place of station. He's highly regarded amongst that society of people. And he's called to the group of people that are nothing like him. Gentiles. People that have no reverence for the law. They don't follow any of it. And that's like what he knows the most. And he's called to that group of people. While Peter, who is a fisherman, a laborer, did not have a high station, was trained as a boy in Torah, but did not pursue it farther than that, who also would have had dealings with Gentiles through his trade, who actually probably would have been accessible to them just by like, hey, I'm like you guys. Like, I work just like you guys work. He's called to the religious epicenter of his people to lead the church. And these Pharisees that become followers of Jesus have a really hard time acknowledging that everything that their lives are built around, they don't have to do anymore. And actually, it's not even just that they don't have to do it. It's the thing that makes them stand above everybody else because they're the best at it. Like, oh, I can do this in my sleep. And I tout it in front of everybody. And so there's this group of rogue teachers that are just going around telling people, it's like, yeah, if you can follow our Messiah, but you got to clean yourself up first. And then you can become a part of this thing. And that's what Paul calls them. He says, they make much of you so that they can actually shut you out and make more of themselves. That's his warning in this Galatians passage. And so I wanted to focus in on something. That's that backstory that I wanted to share from Acts. But I've kind of lovingly called this the Galatian situation, meaning that this moment is not just about informing your theology. It's a lot more than that, because Paul has been given a mission to spread the gospel to everybody, to the Gentiles, and the way that it's actually going to create a huge amount of tension in the church, because Paul's efforts bring hundreds, if not thousands, of new believers into the faith, and none of them are Jewish. And so there's this pivotal moment for the church, which Paul stands up for adamantly, which is this one question. Is the gospel actually for everyone? Like, is it actually for everyone? Kirk brought up an amazing point when he preached the other day that if you had to follow the law of Moses, like, it's not even just circumcision, it's cutting your body to be made part of a people group and then following what that people group follows. If that's what you had to do to follow Jesus, then the gospel isn't for everybody. It's for Jewish people, because you have to be made Jewish to follow the Jewish Messiah. And that's not what Jesus said. That's not what he charged Paul with doing. Like, this is this moment where these two teachings cannot exist at the same time. And so a decision has to be made. And this is really early on in the church. And Paul stands up for what the gospel of Jesus is actually for. Is the gospel for everyone? We say yes. And this is where I want to kind of take a turn, because we talk so much in Galatians about what the law was, what the law was supposed to be, and that you don't have to follow the law. And that's great theology. And he does a great job of pointing to what those things were actually for. But it's not just for your theology. Like, this should actually change something in you. Like, the reason I wanted to share Paul's story was it changed everything for him. His life was dedicated to teaching this system. Jesus shows up to him in this one interaction, says no, and now he's like, all right, cool, no. And he repents, he turns 180 degrees, goes back, and now just is shouting the gospel to everyone that would hear it. So if Jesus came to seek and save the lost, to bring salvation to everyone, then who is the gospel for? Everyone. You can be louder than that too. And if the gospel is for everyone, then who should be able to respond to the invitation? And who's going to invite them? Everyone. Paul isn't just some unicorn of a man. I mean, he kind of is because he's insane. But he does what is called for us to do, to spread out the invitations. If you remember earlier in Antioch, he alludes to this parable that Jesus says. It's the parable of the wedding feast. I wanted to read it to you. It's Matthew 22, 2 through 6. These are Jesus now talking. The kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who gave a wedding feast for his son and sent his servants to call those who were invited to the wedding feast, but they would not come. Again, he sent other servants saying, tell those who are invited, see, I have prepared my dinner. My oxen and my fat calves have been slaughtered and everything is ready. Come to the wedding feast. But they paid no attention and went off, and one to his farm, another to his business, while the rest seized his servants, treated them shamefully, and killed them. What's happening to Paul? Treating him shamefully, trying to kill him. He's only trying to hand out invitations. Look how it goes farther, 8 through 10. He says, this wedding feast is ready, but those invited are not worthy. Go therefore to the main roads and invite to the wedding feast as many as you find. And those servants went out into the roads and gathered all whom they found, both bad and good. So the wedding hall was filled with guests. And I'm going to invite the band to come up. This is huge. Because I feel like sometimes we think that we've just inherited this amazing thing from Jesus, and like that's it. And it is awesome. We receive this inheritance from our Father. The beginning of our text today is this teaching of there are heirs and there are slaves. But he sets the record straight that the heirs are actually no different than the slaves. That we are all adopted into God's kingdom. And because we are made sons, we are made heirs. And if you're heirs, what happens when the time comes to receive the inheritance? Do you do nothing with it? Like if I received an inheritance of this massive plot of land and I had servants and I had workers and I had all these people and I did nothing, I just sat, what do you think would happen? It would just be chaos. Nothing would be getting done that was supposed to get done. When you are an heir and you receive your inheritance, you're supposed to do something with it. And Paul is such an amazing example that when he received his inheritance, the understanding that salvation comes through Jesus, he also understand that with salvation, this inheritance we're talking about, Jesus, also came with it a stack of invitations. That there is a wedding feast and all are invited, good and bad. And I feel like sometimes people that have a hunger for like justice and righteousness have a hard time with this because we think what we're saying is, oh, you don't have to change to follow Jesus. You can keep sinning. You can keep doing whatever you want. God just loves you so much. But it's so critical for us to understand you don't have to just clean yourself up to approach Jesus. It's for you. We need to be open to let Jesus work in our lives to help us grow, to help us to be made more like him. But there's not this gate that's keeping people away to reach some level and then they can approach Jesus. Paul is not gatekeeping Christianity. He's swinging the gates open. He's called to plant the church in a group of people that don't understand who God is, but his motivation is that they would know God and be known by God. I asked the band to sing that song today because there's something about knowing who God is and allowing him to know you, to be in relationship with him. A lot of these people that Paul was called to reach had an empty relationship with elemental spirits of the world. They would make sacrifices, they would cry out to the heavens, but nobody was listening to them because they didn't exist. And then he comes and says, actually, the God who made everything wants you to know him. and he wants to know you. It's not this distant relationship. And so we're going to receive communion today. I'm sorry, I went really late. I hope that's fine. But we're going to do communion. So if you could all stand, we're going to do two things today. The first is this. We're going to receive communion. I want you to come forward. I want you to receive the elements. But when you come back to your seat, I want you to find 4, 5, 6, 10 people. I don't care. Circle up and appoint one of you to pray for the group. And you can throw up those prayers, Gary. The first one is this. We are not going to be a church that exists in this area that does not reach people with the gospel of Jesus Christ. But if you think that I need to throw something on the calendar for you to do that, that's not how Christianity works. Like, we live here, so we witness here. Because it's the joy of our salvation. This is the thing that we live for. And so I also recognize how hard that is. Again, it's why I wanted to bring up Paul's story. It's hard. And we should actually count it a blessing that we probably won't have it as hard as him. We're not going to get stoned in the streets. We're not going to be persecuted the way that he was persecuted. Yet why is it that we can feel so timid and shy? Because we don't want to be the weird guy that talks about Jesus to our friends. We don't want to be the weird person who makes people feel uncomfortable. Listen, this is the hope of the world. It's not a game that we play. This is amazing. And I want you to know that. Like, we've all felt the overwhelming love of God in our life. And that is a gift. And it's freely given. And people need to be able to respond. If the gospel is for everybody, then everybody should hear it. Everybody should have the opportunity to respond. And if they don't, we can shake the dust off our feet and move on to the next person and pray and intercede that they would change, that God would reach their hearts. And so go ahead and start coming forward right now. Sorry, this is going to be a little messy. But just grab it, come back to your seats. I want you guys to circle up. And here's this first prayer. You don't have to pray it specifically, but I want us to come before the Lord with honesty and say, this is really hard. Following Jesus, no matter the cost, is hard. But it says, Lord, place in me the fire and the desire to share the gospel of Christ with the people you have put in my life. Strengthen me when I feel weak. Encourage me when I try and guide me on the journey. God, we want to be faithful servants. And again, if you haven't put your faith in Jesus, feel under no obligation to do this today. I'd actually encourage you not to. But if you believe in Jesus today, let this be a powerful moment to kind of break yourself out of just like this mundane Christian experience. We're called into something amazing that's life-giving. So as you do that, go ahead, find your seats. Just grab a couple people. Just ask one of you to have the boldness to step out and pray. Lord, would you guide me?
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. If you would like to reach out to us or see what we currently have going on as a church, head to anthemcda.com or find us on social media at anthemcda. We can't wait to see you next week.